a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Roll, please.
Gibson?
Here.
Hunstead?
Here.
Hunhoff?
Here.
Lust?
Here.
Valley?
Here.
Hunt?
Here. We have a quorum. You all have received copies of the minutes of our meeting of June 8, 2010. Are there any comments concerning those meetings? And if not, I would entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
Senator Hunstead moves to approve.
Move to approve by Senator Hunstead. Is there a second?
I'll second it. Gibson.
Second.
Seconded by Representative Gibson. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes will say aye.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hunstead?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye. The minutes are approved. Mr. Decker? I assume we're on the internet at this point in time, since you control that button.
Yes, I've...
And does the staff have any report?
No report.
Are there any questions by any members of the committee? All right, hearing none, we'll proceed right to our agenda, and we'll pass the... symbolic gavel to Senator Hunhoff. Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you. Well, Senator Kolchick has joined me here. Well, the Department of Health, the Board of Massage Therapy, which is to amend rules to provide standards for the training schools, third choice for national exam, and clarification. Is there someone present?
Yes, Senator. Here in Sioux Falls, we have a presenter, and she'll take over at this point.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Joyce Voss. I'm the Executive Secretary to the South Dakota Board of Massage Therapy. So I'll be presenting today, and we'll just go ahead and get started. In regard to Rule 2076-0102, I thought it was more formal, or at least better to clarify that there aren't forms necessarily in this rule. The only form they spoke about was the application. So I changed the title to application, and then the information is only in regard to the application. I also added, still on page one in the middle of the body, the executive secretary may return an incomplete application. I brought that sentence forward from the rule we are repealing, which is 0105. And on page two, for the rest of that rule, again, it's just clarification. I'm always hopeful that the general public and or the licensees can get more information and clear information from our rules. So that's generally why I'm before you just about every 2 years, because of the explanations I have to give out over the phone or the questions I hear. So my job is always to clarify as best as possible and address those confusions. So on to 2076-0103. I brought that sentence forward, again, also from 0105, and repealed 0105. It's better stated in the two previous rules. In regard to 0106, when I published the notice and the first draft of our rules, was our attempt to put more information and be more specific in the training that would be acceptable in South Dakota. I don't know if you read our minutes from our public hearing, but Mr. Decker and I worked, well, he was very helpful, and I appreciate is HELP and helping me work through our discussion on whether we can be specific in our training. And it was going to be very laborious and not something I was prepared with at this point in time. So we don't have as many changes to the rule of 0106. We did add that an education verification form is to be completed by the school along with official transcripts. And the reason we have that form completed is because it helps depict the 500 specific hours that are required in the rest of the body of that rule. It's easier when the training program, the school, summarizes those 500 hours, because I certainly don't have the skill or knowledge to interpret their official transcripts and know the content of their classes. So that is very helpful. The other sentence that I added, the board may consider other evidence of training if the school has ceased operations. And that's important because we do have a couple of situations that this board is going to have to consider. We have got applicants waiting to be considered whose schools are just no longer in existence. They may or may not have transcripts still in their possession, but either or, we can't get official transcripts or the verification form completed by the school because it no longer exists. So that's going to be some work that the board's going to have to do with a couple of applications we have pending. I'm going to move on to page 4, qualifying activities, rule 2706-03-04. Again, I was trying to clarify, and in so I took part of that rule and put it into the one above it, 0301, because it was more of a definition. And so it is addressed in statute, but it couldn't be found specifically as a definition in rule. So again, I was helping out the licensees in being able to find the information or at least clearly know the information. Another addition we made on page 4 is to add massage therapy of the human body. And that was discussed by the board, and it was decided as something we needed to put in there, in particular because there are massage therapists that do equine massage therapy. And since our mission is to protect the general public, not necessarily the animals, we really did have to put that in there because it has been a challenging question that has been brought about when they turn in continuing ed and they've actually gone to continuing ed that was teaching them to do pet therapy, pet massage therapy. On to page 5, we again clarified what a qualifying activity is acceptable from the board. It must meet the definition of massage therapy as defined in the statute 3635.1 sub 2. An example of that is that we have, for instance, local people and, for instance, a chiropractor in Brookings that presents continuing ed that meets the definition but is not an approved provider through the two national entities, I guess you could call them, which is the National Certification Board for Massage, Therapeutic Massage and Body Work, or the American Medical Massage Association. Now, those examples, if a continuing ed course that they went to does not meet our definition, which is basically the systematic mobilization of the soft tissue of the body, but instead they go to continuing ed that is presented by an approved provider, but it's more removed from the hands-on body massage, which would be like aromatherapy or yoga or raindrop therapy is another one. There's actually 54 pages of types of massage therapy that exists out there. And many of them are They do not present the hands-on systematic mobilization of the soft tissue. But it may enhance their work, it may enhance their practice. So if it's presented by one of these approved entities, then it meets our continuing ed requirements. Moving on to inactive license 2076-0601, there was not a statement that addressed with what happens when the people do reactivate their license. Because this is a new board, there wasn't a situation where, until recently, where somebody needed to go inactive and then shortly thereafter want to reactivate their license. So there wasn't a statement as to, do they retain their license date? When is their continuing ed compliance date now? And so we had to add in there that they never lose their issue date, and therefore they will always be in the same cycle for their renewal and their CE compliance. So there's no confusion there. And again, it's presented, it's stated in the rule. And so they can find it, and it can help them understand that. Moving on to page 6 on examinations. The only information that was available to the licensees and supported for this board was in statute. It was the only reference to an exam that was acceptable to the board. So not only did we decide that it was important to list the two exams acceptable to the board, but a third one is now available in the country, and that's the Federation of State Massage Therapy Board's exam called the MBLEX. That exam came about in the fall of 2007. It's an exam that tests more for a licensing board than a certification entity. It is a little less expensive than the certification exam, and it is accepted in so many states that we have had applicants that are moving to South Dakota, and that's the only exam they have taken. So it would be a shame to have them take a national certification exam if they've already taken the Federation exam and they're licensed in another state. So that's another reason we would like to add that to our list of acceptable exams. That's all I have to say. I'll certainly entertain questions.
Thank you. Are there questions? I have one. Go ahead, Cedar Valley.
Two questions. One, are we all inclusive now in the national organizations that represent massage therapy? I think early on when we did this, in fact, I think I was the only guy that voted against this on the first time around, because we left out a national group. Are they all included now?
I'm not sure. Are you talking about the exams or the national associations that exist out there for the profession?
The national associations. Are they the study that they of the practices they use, is that included in these now?
I guess I'm not sure. I wasn't around, but I understand some of what was going on during the lobbying and the legislation draft. And I think they were addressing that, such as AMTA is a great supporter, or ABMP, you know, is or is not a great supporter. We don't address the national associations anywhere in our statutes or our rules.
Okay.
The only reference to any other entity would be the examinations. But we aren't a member of those organizations because it is, I mean, the board isn't, the licensing board is not. That would be for the licensees to join and make the decision what national association they want to join. So I guess I'm excited. But yes, I guess a reference to those associations would be where the licensees can get their insurance. So I do see insurance coming in from their membership with ABMP or AMTA. And certainly, yes, if the insurance that they are holding meets our statute, it's certainly acceptable. Other than that, we don't address any national association.
Okay. My second question, if I may, Madam Chair, is how many licensees do we have now?
Wow. Around 750.
Do you know what you projected? It seems like they were talking around 400, and now we're almost double that. Is that true? Did this work pretty well for folks?
I have the board chair here with me, and she was around during that development, and she believes they were projecting 500 licensees.
Okay. The reason I was wondering is, at that time, there was a discussion, you know, it was up to $100 to get a license, and I think it was dropped to, what, 50 to 65, somewhere in there. And just because there's a lot of part-time therapists, and don't know if that's been discussed or hashed over by you folks.
It was changed. It went back to session. It was changed probably in 08 from a biennial license plus application for $300. So it was reduced to a $100 application fee and a $65 annual license fee. So it was reduced considerably.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question, and it has to do with your examinations on page 6. Is the content the same in all three of those examinations?
No, it is not. And in fact, number one, the National Certification Board for Therapeutic Massage and Bodywork, they actually provide two exams. One is massage and bodywork, which is more of the Eastern modality, or you can just take the therapeutic massage exam. So there's two choices for our licensees right there. Number two, the American Medical Massage Association, that again has different content. It's more medically based, and the way it's provided and the cost of it is quite different from both the other exams. You pay one fee of about, maybe $265, perhaps. That might be too high. But you can take it as many times as you need to until you pass it at no additional cost. Works really well for some people. And then the Federation, that content is totally different again. The content to the Federation exam was developed by licensees and with the help of licensing boards, taking content from statute and administrative rules that existed back in from 2005 to 2007 when they had the job analysis taking place and they were developing their content. So there are really four different exams available, and if the applicant would go into the handbooks, they could discern which exam fit them the best by reading some of the content areas.
This leads to my question. If I'm a licensed massage therapist and I hang out my shingle, then I, as someone trying to buy the service, really don't know, other than what's advertised, if that person can provide whatever massage type, because we've got four different kinds of content. How do I know there's not consistency there? And I'll use, you've got a lawyer sitting in front of you. I'm a nurse. If we're licensed, you know the practice that we're expected or the standard. But if you've got four different with different contents, how do I know where I'm going and what I'm getting is what I'm really paying for? You know, if the lady sitting next to you would like to respond, you certainly can. You just need to identify yourself if you're the chair of the board to help your executive director here.
I can explain that to you. I am Laura Whitey. I am the president of the South Dakota Massage Therapy Board. And I also work for National American University as the Massage Therapy Program Coordinator. And I have had experiences with all four examinations. And relatively, the similarity between all four is that they all have the basic core concepts down. They all require anatomy. They all require pathology. They all require your basic massage modality knowledge. The difference would be the bodywork examination for the National Certification Exam would include energy work. That would be more of the Chinese medicine. Whereas the other test the National Certification requires is just your basic massage therapy that does not include energy work. The medical massage, it's more in depth, it's more medical, so you have to have more requirement for anatomy, more kinesiology requirements, more patho requirements. And again, the Federation exam is basically it was designed by licensees. So again, it has the anatomy requirements, it has the patho requirements, it has the kinesiology. So that's what they all have in common. It's just that you can differentiate yourself and what you specialize in by taking different exams. Does that help?
It does, but as a consumer, all I see is that this person is licensed, and as I'm saying, not being familiar with that in the sense that coming from what I understand about licensing, everybody meets the same standards, but in this type, they don't, because you just said if I want to get into the Chinese type, I've got more. But my license doesn't say that. It just says I'm a licensed massage therapist. That's where I'm going.
I understand that. I'll put it in perspective. Say a chiropractor has a chiropractic license, but they also may have an acupuncture. They know how to do acupuncture, but that doesn't necessarily have that in their license. Does that kind of make sense? And acupuncture is a Chinese medicine theory. Does that help at all?
The other issue, Senator, would be that think of the 438, and I'm, again, approximizing because I was hired at the end of the grandfathering period, and that number sticks in my head. We grandfathered approximately 438 of them in. And I would say 408 of them never took an exam. But they are out there and they are practicing. So there's a greater difference there, is that they were not required to take any exam and their shingle is out there, but they're covered by the same insurance and they're regulated just like the rest of the licensees. And they have to do the continuing ed just like the rest of the licensees.
And I was there for this debate, and believe me, that was all debated in there, and that was sort of a compromise that was done. And so the base is set. Now we move forward. I won't drag this on, so if anybody else has any other questions for the two presenters.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Voss, if I could have you turn to page 2 of your packet. I have a couple questions for you on the notification provision on the bottom of page 2. First, is the notification from the secretary or of the board's approval or disapproval required to be in writing?
Absolutely. Because right above it in the body of that rule, it says if the applicant does not meet the requirements, the executive secretary shall write a letter of explanation.
Okay, very good. Why does it take so long? The last sentence of the notification section, 6 months seems an awfully long time.
I just brought that forward from the rule that was repealed, 0105.
Is that much time needed?
No. No, not unless it's a complicated arrangement such as the school that has ceased to operate and we're seeking more information or the applicant needs more time to locate the previous owner or trainer that they had. Those do take a little bit longer, but no, as a rule, I would never wait 6 months unless there's something very unusual going on.
But as you look at these rules in the future, you may want to shorten that time period. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt.
Go ahead.
Following on Representative Lust's general comments, how often does the board meet to deal with these applications? As the need arises, or every week, every month?
At the time, it's as the need arises, when there's enough content to call a meeting together, or if there's an urgency, we've had board meetings via conference call and done it as quickly as possible.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Again, following on Senator Hunhoff's comments, I think my question to Ms. Voss and to the profession is whether or not the profession is looking at specialists, shall we say. For example, as an attorney, if I want to hold myself out in a particular specialty, perhaps a trial lawyer or as a estate planner, etc., the law in a number of states, and as a practical matter, we would take extra courses, continuing education, etc., in that particular area. And I'm wondering if, when we talk in terms of Oriental or Chinese medicine or acupuncture, if maybe that isn't the subspecialty that, in essence, the profession should look at to help identify those therapists who are really accomplished and licensed or could be licensed in those particular areas. And I think it might get to Senator Hunhoff's primary question. In other words, if I look at a particular massage therapist, I wouldn't know, you know, what they really do other than, you know, massage the body. But these other things, it seems to me, could be some sort of specialist. Now, I realize this is a new profession, new license, but it may be something that the profession wants to look at to develop a little in the way of some specialties so that we can have more complete honesty in advertising, if you would. I throw that out not so much as a recommendation for any of these rules, but with the consideration that the community of the profession might want to look at that and develop some special guidelines accordingly, whether they be licensing, continuing education, etc. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. Any other questions? Okay, are there any other proponents? Any other proponents at other sites? Are there any opponents? Opponents? Opponents. Seeing none, I will close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for discussion or action by the committee.
Madam Chair, I move that we accept the rules as written.
I'll second. Gibson.
Okay. Senator Valley moves to approve the rules as presented. Representative Gibson seconds. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none. The motion before the committee. Those in favor of approving the rules signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much for your presentation, and I will move it to Senator Hunstead.
Thank you. We are got three packages of rules that I'm going to be working with here. The first one is the Department of Agriculture. agronomy services dealing with bees and bee diseases. If there's someone there to present, I would ask them to come to the microphone, introduce themselves for the audience, and proceed with their testimony. Is there someone in here?
Is that better? Okay. I'm Bob Reiners with the South Dakota Department of Ag, and just to briefly go over our rule packet here. We added the segment, the independent third party. When I started here in 1984, virtually every state had an apiary inspection program, and with budget constraints around many states in the country, we've eliminated, or there's been apiary programs eliminated. For the beekeepers to come into the state, they need to obtain an entrance permit, and they have to get an inspection from their state of origin. And when there wasn't that party there or that person, we looked at this segment to be able to provide an independent person that would provide some level of inspection that has bee expertise and could give some certification for those bees. So that was where the independent third party came from. We just clarified a little bit on like 1241.0301 on the landowner permission. We just changed a few words instead of saying he to the person and removing the question where it said when the location is sold, that meaning that was the land where the bees were occupied. We put another segment in revocation of permits. The way the rules currently read, that if bees weren't placed on those locations or parcels of land, that every year that the location could be revoked by our department. And you got to understand, parts of the western part of the state have been plagued with 5 to 6 years of drought, and so the industry had requested some leniency there on that part, that they could have at least two out of the last 5 years where they maybe wouldn't have stocked their locations with bees because they would have been feeding them to keep them alive.
Excuse me, before you continue on, we're having some technical difficulties in getting the camera onto the presenter. That's why you're seeing the room with other people, but the person that's not speaking. We're working on correcting the camera problem.
Okay. We eliminated a segment on tracheal mite in 1241.0405. Tracheal mite first was detected in the United States in 1984. By 1987 and 88, a lot of the bees were really heavily parasitized. We had a lot of colony losses. At that point in time, we had a shot in the dark of what was basically a tolerance or an infestation level. Now bees have developed some natural immunity or resistance to it, and we don't do any testing anymore. There's hardly any other states beekeepers can get that done at some private labs and federal labs, so we eliminated that segment. Talking about varroa mite, we had specifically put in a tolerance and a certain method using a chemical apistan, and the mites have since become resistant to that chemical, so it isn't really even a valid detection method anymore, and so we elaborated and put in some different methods that are accepted for testing for varroa mite, and we eliminated the tolerance. That mite number we had for tolerance was actually very high for a spring detection. In the fall, it would be relatively low. The contested case segment was a request upon by the Attorney General's office. We're not eliminating the contested case process for beekeepers, but just merely the time constraints that the hearing would be conducted within 30 days and that the 20 days afterwards, or that the final decision would be issued within 20 days after the hearing. It was just cumbersome and too limiting for them with their workload to get that all accomplished. The entrance permits, we basically eliminated, the industry had asked that we basically eliminate all the constraints dealing with Africanized bees. The Africanized bees had moved up through Central America and through Mexico and into some of the southern border states. That actually is the natural migration has moved up somewhat to northern Oklahoma. A lot of the beekeepers, for the most part, are monitoring their own breeding or genetics, and basically it was most of the states in this area, we would be impossible to get our certification from, so we wouldn't even be able to obtain compliance with our own entrance permit rules. So we eliminated all the segments regarding Africanized bees for entrance permit rules. Part with the varroa mite. Varroa mite was another pest that was like a tick on a bee that became detected here in the late 80s. And again, virtually every state now has varroa mite, and basically we changed it. It had had previously the rules had stated from bees and colonies from states infested, and then the second one was entrance permits for bees and colonies infested. Well, the second one was basically eliminated and combined with the first one, and we just expanded the detection techniques away from Apistan and just kind of clarified that. For American foulbrood, that's where basically a lot of our programs came from. American foulbrood is a bacterial disease of bees, and has basically became a widespread problem in the late 40s and 50s. Now, since then, we still have foulbrood, but now we've come up with certain antibiotic-resistant strains of American foulbrood. We didn't want to eliminate any of the restrictions or requirements to come in, but we just changed it instead of stating from states, because virtually every state has some foulbrood, but now we just change it to in colonies infested with American foulbrood. The entrance permits for the queens and the bees and the combless packages, they still have to get a entrance permit to come in, but again, that had stipulated it had to be the Apistan placed in those package cages, and that the bees or the mites had become resistant to that chemical, so we eliminated that, and just basically stated that the shipper has to get his parent colony certified before they can be shipped. There is one change in the packet of the rules that you were sent out on the last rule regarding small hive beetle. We had basically changed the wording a little bit, where the old rule had said approved compound, and when I'd corresponded back and forth with Doug, Mr. Decker, his question was who approved it, and I had indicated the EPA approval, and what it chemical company does, they get EPA approval and then they register with each individual state. So we changed that from in your packet. Now it should read a product that is registered by the South Dakota Department of Agriculture for that use, and we can get a copy of that rule change to you if you so desire. That pretty much covers all the proposed rule changes we had, if anyone has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reiner. Are there any members of the committee that have a question for Mr. Reiner?
Mr. Chair?
Proceed.
My question is on the varroa mite, why did we eliminate the tolerance level? I mean, we say how you treat it, but we didn't do anything for a tolerance level. Is there not a way that you can test for that tolerance, or why was that eliminated?
The issue being that the level that we had picked, I believe it was 11 mites. If you have 11 mites in the springtime, your colonies will be crashing by late fall. That is too high a level. If you had 11 mites in the fall in September, those colonies will thrive quite well. I mean, in northern states, kind of a rule of thumb, if you have 8 mites or less in August, you could probably get by without treating until the following spring. So basically that 11 mites when we originally established that, or 10-11 mites, was kind of a shot in the dark. Our best guess at the time when we established that rule.
I guess my question still would be, why did you eliminate it? I mean, if you found out 11 was too high a threshold, why didn't you say change that from 11 to 8 in the fall and 4 in the spring or whatever? Was there a reason why you didn't have a threshold there?
No, not really. I guess we just some of the industry feel that if they're not treating for their mites, they're going to get be eliminated from doing business. But no, there's no real reason We just, I guess we could have changed that and put a lower level in the spring and a higher level in the fall, but we just eliminated it.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Please follow up.
The reason I'm asking is the 3 mile limit, does that take care of some of this problem? I mean, if I've got more mites, in my group, there's no fences for bees. So if they're out flying around and I don't know what their range is, if it's over 3 miles, if you can maybe help me understand that 3 mile so that if a neighbor has Varroa mites, am I going to get infested in that 3 mile area?
That's a good question. Bees do 90% of their work in the first mile. Considering they will fly farther than that, they definitely will fly up 2 miles or more when they're pressed to do that. Their efficiency drops off, but that was why that 3 mile law was established, so that they would, bulk of their flying would, they wouldn't be commingling and spreading that pest from colony or apiary to apiary.
Okay, so I guess that answers my questions on these. Has there been any discovery on why some of these hives have all of a sudden, there was a great problem with a lot of these hives dying, and no one knew the reason? Has that research found anything at this point?
That's a very good question. There's a lot of concerns. I know everything from cell phone signals, to chemicals. What we're definitely seeing is they initially identified a virus. It was termed Israeli acute paralysis virus. And also in their initial testing, 96% of those samples were also positive with a microintestinal disorder called Nosema. They didn't quantify the level of infection in those bees. They just checked for presence or absence. At the same time, we discovered that we had a new strain of Nosema that jumped from the Asian bee into the European bee, and it basically had moved all around the country. We don't know if there seems to be some correlation or interaction between the viruses and the Nosema. The viruses are spread by the Varroa mite as they bite and pierce on the bee, and they vector the virus into the honeybee. What they found is if you keep your mite control in force, you can eliminate a lot of stress, but there still seems to be some problem with the Nosema level and the viruses. There are some other issues. We have to treat for these mites in these colonies, and they've done a lot of work on chemical interactions that are occurring, that maybe that the chemicals the bees are encountering out while they're foraging, they're bringing back to the hive, and there's some kind of interaction that's occurring within their colony. But no, we don't have an actual pinpointed cause. Boy, if we could, the industry would love it.
One final one, Mr. Chair.
Please,
I would encourage you to, again, look at the tolerance level you have for the Varroa mite, because it appears it might be one of the causes for the hive deaths. And beekeeping is, I mean, in South Dakota, I think we're the second largest producer of honey. So it's very important, and I don't want to see us, get too lax and allow disease to come in here. So that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Valley. Are there any further questions by any other members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hunt.
Go ahead, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you just comment again on the contested case procedure, your repeal of those statutes? What was your reason for doing that?
We were requested by the Attorney General's office to remove those time constraints for it was just making it too unworkable. We had a very complex hearing back in 07 and involved a few different parties, and we couldn't get that hearing organized and done within the 30 days, and to get all of the summary of the hearing done within the 20 days afterwards. So we were requested by the Attorney General's office just to repeal those two time constraint segments from the contested case procedure.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, was there an opportunity expressed by the Attorney General just to change the dates? In other words, the number of days, lengthen the days?
In the email that I got, I believe there was some discussion. They weren't aware of, I don't believe there was any other agency that had those type of time constraints. It was just requested to eliminate those two segments.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question, but I do have a comment here. My neighbor across the street from me is, or my neighbors are George and Deb McLean. They have McLean's Honey and have been in the apiary business for many years. I took the packet over to Mr. McLean and had him review it, and he says that he does concur with the Beekeepers Association positions, and he feels all the changes that were made to the rules are much better. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gibson. Are there any further questions? I have one, but I'm going to let the rest of you ask first. Hearing no further questions, let me then proceed. The only question I'm going to ask about is the Asian bees, and you said that they've moved up into Oklahoma. Perhaps they can't live this far north, but I do know that bees move up and down the road, so I guess just for my own information and to learn about bees, if they happen to come up here, would they just die off, or what does happen?
The comment was regarding Asian bees, but it's Africanized bees, and it's kind of interesting. In Brazil and some of the mountainous areas, they did find Africanized bees that could actually survive at higher elevations, what would be probably somewhat similar to our temperate climate here. The nature that they have demonstrated thus far is that when they're collecting nectar, they burn a lot of their nectar up or consume their honey, raising additional young baby bees. Our European bees, on the other hand, have a hoarding tendency, and that they have the wonderful capacity to collect and store much more honey than they need for their own use, thereby giving the beekeepers a source of income. But and they don't tend to burn up all of their honey. We do have some concerns. If you are maintaining certified breeder stock, good breeder European stock, and you have an F1 cross, meaning your breeder queen was European, and those queens that you raised from her crossed once with your Africanized drones, they're pretty manageable. The problem starts becoming if you start selecting your own breeder stock back out of your own operation, then you could end up with getting more inbreeding and developing a lot more of the aggressive characteristics. But yes, our industry is on wheels. When I started here, we probably had 25% of our colony still wintered here in the state. I don't know if we have maybe even a few thousand hives with hobbyists that are wintered here. Everything else leaves to go to California for pollination or to southern states for wintering, or a combination of southern states then out to California for almonds and then maybe up the west coast and back here. And we've even had bees that go from here and out to California, back to Oklahoma, out to Maine, and then back here, and maybe Wisconsin for cranberries on the way home. So our bees do definitely move on wheels, and that was the reason with the industry basically wanted to make some of these changes for their entrance permits.
Thank you for that. And I do know that they move around, and I've often wondered if this isn't, you know, why the diseases have come in. But at any rate, I have been satisfied, as well as Representative Gibson, that my local beekeepers were happy with the rules as you presented them. Are there any further questions from any other members of this committee? Hearing none, are there any further proponents? Are there any further proponents? Hearing none, are there any opponents? Any opponents? Hearing none, I'm going to close to public testimony and open up for discussion and or action by the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move due pass of these rules.
I have a motion by Representative Gibson, due pass. Is there a second?
Representative Hunt seconds.
I have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, I will ask the secretary to read the roll. Vote aye to pass this motion, to pass this set of rules.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye. So we're ready to move on to the second package that I have, and that would be dealing with the Division of Insurance. If you will approach.
We're going to try and do it. This is Doug at Pier. We're going to try and do a workaround on the camera problem and have the presenters come up to the committee table and make their presentations. You can just pick one of the mics that are open, Randy, and proceed from there.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Randy Moses, Division of Insurance. Rules that we are bringing forth deal with when it's life insurance policy. There's an amendment sought to it, or a rider sought to that policy. House Bill 1206, which was passed this last legislative session, kind of brought this issue to a little bit of a head. And we also became aware of, on a totally separate situation, a life insurer who wanted to amend a policy without the policyholder's written consent. We did not feel that was appropriate under the current statutes, and felt that any change that adversely affected a policyholder should, in fact, be agreed to, that one party should not be allowed to unilaterally change the terms and conditions of a contract. So that was the genesis for these rules. Considerable discussion with some of the attorneys who were interested in it, as well as the life insurance industry who was interested in these rules. And what you see is a kind of an in-between between the two sides as far as what they wanted. What we ended up with is that the policies must be signed by the policyholder if, in fact, they're going to be changed. And that any changes sent by the insurance company must be accompanied by a full explanation of those changes and its effect on those policyholders. There were some exceptions carved out in the second section of the rule, and that is where the change in the policy is required by law, or if the change actually benefits the policyholder and does not increase the premium. That is the rule in a nutshell, and I stand by for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I did read through the package and found out that there were lots of feedback back and forth with respect to this. And I don't have any real questions about this, but a remark about working with the Division of Insurance, that I am happy to continue to note that your main goal seems to be working for the people, as we, as representatives of those people, are happy with you about that. Are there any questions by any members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, there is one thing I forgot to mention. There is a slight error in the rules as drafted. I did mention that to Doug Decker just prior to the meeting today, and that is in 2006-08-48, the general authority that cites 58-14-45 should be at 15-45, and likewise in law implemented where it cites 14-45, it should be 58-15-45, and we will get that corrected. Right, Doug?
Yes.
Thank you for that. And are there any questions of Mr. Moses?
Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Can there be any penalty whatsoever if I do not sign this endorsement?
Senator, the policyholder would not be able to be penalized for not signing an endorsement if, in fact, a signature is required. No, that would not be allowed.
So you couldn't discontinue my insurance? There can be, if I don't sign this, there's no, let's say that the endorsement has a negative effect on me, and I say, there's no way I'm signing this. There can be no repercussions for not signing it.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions, Mr. Moses?
Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead and Representative Lust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Moses, I see in the attached documents there is some discussion as to whether or not there should be a provision in the endorsement or the modification that that requires the insurer to inform the insured or the policy owner that they need not sign the amendment. But I don't see that language in the change. Can you explain why that's not in there?
Representative Lust, I don't specifically recall that exact comment. I do recall considerable debate on making sure that the policyholders are adequately informed about the nature of the exclusion or restriction that was to be requested to be signed, and that the language that we put in there concerning there be a full and fair disclosure of the effect, we felt signing the endorsement was then, and that it's optional, took care of that situation. So I think that's taken care of, but maybe I'm missing the particular concern that you are honed in on.
No, that's fine. If you're comfortable that saying it's optional is clear enough, and it probably is, that's fine.
Are there any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt.
Representative Hunt, proceed.
Mr. Moses, at the bottom of page 2, the exceptions to signing the endorsement, the last phrase is kind of a catch-all, or does not adversely affect the insured. Can you give us two or three examples of what would adversely affect the insured other than the items that are already included in that particular rule?
Representative, you mean not adversely affect the insured?
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay. Probably a real common example would be this. There's a merger of a couple of insurance companies. We have a successor insurance company that has a new name that actually is providing the life insurance for this policyholder. In that instance, they may send out an endorsement saying, your insurance is now with this new company, XYZ company, as opposed to the old company. That would be a real common thing. Ministerial or housekeeping kinds of things is really what we're talking about here.
So it's my understanding these are just administrative things that you anticipate being included in that phrase doesn't adversely affect the insured.
Yes. Yes, we would not certainly not want to see it to where it's something real substantive and in any way would affect the policyholder as far as the substance of the terms and conditions of the contract. Or likewise that we are allowing not being signed if it's actually favorable. Maybe they add a benefit or something like that. But we certainly, where it adversely affects the insured, we certainly want to make sure that there's a signature.
Thank you, Mr. Moses. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and thanks for the question. And when I first looked through here, what I was concerned with is there was going to be so many sheets of paper going to the insured that they had to sign to put in their packet. And so I thought this 2006-08-48 was a really good piece to make sure that we don't have too many forms that have to be signed. They become not as important if there's too many. Are there any further questions? Are there any further proponents? Any further? Is there any opponents? Any opponents? Sounds like we've done pretty well with this set. I think then I will close this meeting of public testimony and open it up for discussion and or action by this committee.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the rules as presented with the one change that they are going to make in the law that was referenced to.
Second.
I have a motion and a second to pass this set of rules with the change in the general authority to 58-1545. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, I'm going to ask the secretary to read the roll. Vote aye to pass on this motion to pass this set of rules.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye. Thank you. And this set of rules has also been passed. So we're ready to move on to yet the third one I have, and this is the Department of Transportation. I see we have a presenter there. If you will introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Nevin with the Department of Transportation. I have two speed zone rules in Union County and two rules regarding interstate traffic generating signs for your consideration this morning. The agenda, I believe, also lists a Lawrence County speed zone rule. However, the public hearing was not held in June as originally scheduled due to an error in the notice that was published in the newspaper. It contained an incorrect highway designation. So we started the process over, and the public hearing on this Lawrence County speed zone rule will be at the Transportation Commission's monthly meeting this Thursday. For informational purposes at this time, the Lawrence County rule is to extend an existing 45-mile-an-hour limited speed zone on U.S. Highway 85 past the new convention center gaming complex, the Lodge at Deadwood, by Mount Roosevelt. There has been a left turn lane constructed there for that project. However, the anticipated traffic volumes warranted the lower speed limit, and Deadwood requested that we do that. So I'll present that more fully next time. The rules I do have for the committee, excuse me, the first one, 70-01-02-62, subsection 2, is on the I-29 business loop. This speed zone rule is being amended to extend the 35-mile-an-hour zone through what currently is a 45-mile-an-hour zone from the exit 15 interchange at Elk Point north. The change speed is commensurate with development that is occurring in that location, and this change was requested by the city of Elk Point. because that rule will now encompass the highway segment that currently is addressed in subsection 7 of that rule, the subsection 7 rule is being repealed. Subsection 7 created a 25-mile-an-hour speed zone past the off-ramps at exit 15 on the crossover road going across the interstate. And it was instituted or implemented because of limited sight distances as vehicles are coming over that crossover road and approaching the off-ramps at exit 15. The limited sight distance, it was believed at the time, warranted a 25-mile-an-hour speed zone there. However, that wasn't being obeyed. Motorists weren't really aware of the reason for having that reduced speed there, and the law enforcement advises us that it was routinely ignored. That segment will now be part of the 35-mile-an-hour zone described in the amended rule, the first one, and the department will post intersection warning signs with supplemental advisory speed signs to make motorists aware of those off-ramp intersections, and it's felt that this will be a more effective method of controlling the speed there. The other two rules I have relate to signage for interstate traffic generating facilities. Certain prescribed facilities located off of the interstate are eligible for supplemental guide signs directing interstate traffic to their location. The city of Belle Fourche was interested in a supplemental guide sign on Interstate 90 for the Center of the Nation facility up there. The facility is an appropriate facility for such signage in terms of general type. However, it didn't fit into one of the existing eligible categories for such facilities. And those categories are an airport, higher education institution, military base, arena, auditorium, convention hall, Missouri River dams, fairgrounds, national historic sites, national parks, nature areas, recreation areas, etc. This amendment to 7004-0101 will add the category Geographical Significant Site Reference Center to the types of facilities that are eligible for supplemental guide signs. Also being amended is Rule 7004-0105, and that's the rule that establishes the criteria to be met for a Geographical Significant Site Reference Center facility in order to be eligible for such signage. And those requirements include that the site be of national or state significance, that it provide public parking and public restroom facilities, it has to be open Monday through Friday at least 40 hours a week, and it has to be within 50 miles of an interstate interchange. And in this case, it is within 50 miles of exit 10 off I-90 near Spearfish. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand by if there are any questions on any of those rules.
Thank you, Mr. Nevin. Are there any questions of Mr. Nevin at this time about this package of rules? Are there any questions by any members of the committee? I would have one, Mr. Nevin, and it doesn't deal with this rule package at all. It does have to deal with the little blue signs that I see once in a while. It says that there's a hunting preserve along not a interstate, but along our state highways, and I was wondering how you might apply for one of those. This is just purely for my education. Thank you.
Yes, Senator, you could go to the your local area office of the Department of Transportation and make application. And assuming that you qualified, you could get one. I believe you're referring to what are called TOD signs, tourist-oriented directional signs. They're the small blue ones that might advertise a bed and breakfast here or a hunting preserve or something. But at the DOT area office, or you could call me and we'll help you.
Well, thank you very much. I was wondering about them because I was wondering who was paying for them at the time, and I just curious to me as I drove down the road. So thank you. Are there any further questions of Mr. Nevin?
Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Did you do any study or see when you're adding this geographical significance, if we're going to add a whole bunch of more signs on the interstate, or is there just a couple that would probably pop up?
Mr. Chairman, really, we don't expect an influx of these types of facilities seeking additional signage. The center of the nation facility is somewhat unique with respect to a geographical site. So, we don't anticipate there's going to be a great influx that will generate a lot of new signs on the interstate. For this particular facility, there will be a sign on the westbound for westbound traffic on the interstate before exit 10, and then another sign at the exit providing the direction for travelers. So those will be the only two signs additional associated with this facility.
Thank you.
And I'm assuming, as a follow-up to that, that they would have to apply to your department again, to someone, and be approved at any rate. And I guess the question would be that you would have to modify this if it gets out of hand.
That is correct. They would need to apply through the Department of Transportation, and there is a procedure in place for administering those applications. And yes, if we perceived a problem, we'd want to revisit the issue, I'm sure.
Thank you. Are there any further questions to Mr. Nevin?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Gibson, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nevin, you don't have the cost of the signs for the Center of the World signs included in the packet. Did you explain that they were going to be before us at another time, or do you not know the cost of those signs?
Representative Gibson, I believe that is included on page 12 of your packet. The packet pages should be numbered consecutively. And I've got a copy of what I understand to be the packet you received. And in the fiscal notes document, it does identify that the two new signs for the interstate traffic generating signage will cost about $6,500. And the reason that's so high is that the nature of the sign is such, it's called an extruded panel signs on I-beam posts, and they need to be set in concrete footings. And so they're significantly more expensive than your routine highway sign. But if you don't have that information, I apologize. It should have been included in your packet.
I do have it. I just didn't know if that I just wanted a clarification that that was the actual cost for those signs. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
As a follow-up to that, Mr. Nevin, I have it on page 10 of my digital copy, and mine says 7,215.
Yes, that is the total, including the new signs for the speed zone rules that we've addressed.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions? Hearing none, are there any further proponents? Are there any opponents? Are there any opponents? Hearing none, I'm going to close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for discussion and or action by this committee.
Mr. Chairman, move approval.
Representative Love seconds.
I have a motion by Representative Hunt and a second by Representative Lust to approve this set of rules. Are there any further discussion? Hearing none, I'm going to ask the Secretary to read the roll, vote aye to pass this set of rules on transportation.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye. And I'm going to say that this set of rules also passed, and I'm going to pass the gavel to Representative Lust in Rapid City.
Thank you, Senator Hunstead. At this time, we'll hear testimony from the Board of Education regarding proposed rules and amendments to the Code of Ethics for Teachers. Any proponents of those rule changes, please come forward.
Good morning. My name is Paul Bichon. I'm an attorney in Pierre, and I act as general counsel for the Professional Teachers Practices and Standards Commission. I have three rules for consideration today. Let me just take perhaps a couple seconds just to remind this committee of the Professional Teachers Practices and Standards Commission. That is a statutorily created entity. The Teachers Commission is made up of six teachers and one parent, and the parent has to be obviously of a student. They have statutory obligations for writing and creating codes of ethics, recommending rules to the Board of Education, and also holding hearings on teachers who have violated the code of ethics. And so in front of us today, you have a couple rules. Their code of ethics is divided into three parts: obligations to students, obligations to the public, and obligations to the profession. And the first two rules we're going to talk about deal with obligations to the student and to the public. If you look at the proposed amendments to Rule 2408-0301, that is creating a section that would prohibit essentially sexual conduct or sexual activity between teachers and students. What we have seen, an alarming type trend, I would suggest, over the last couple of years, is commission action that is had to have been taken on teachers. And the teachers involve sexual communication via emails with students, and it also involves the sexual conduct between teachers and students. Those have been brought under differing sections of the Code of Ethics in front of you, sub 7 and sub 8, maintaining professional relationships without exploitation of a student for personal gain or advantage. That's sub 7, sub 9. Maintaining that professional relationship in a manner free of vindictiveness, recrimination, and harassment. I hesitate to say that's somewhat of a square peg in a round hole because those have fit in the past, but I think it's clear, and the direction from the Teachers Commission is to draft and then to review and implement a suggested change to the Code of Ethics. It would simply delineate that type of sexual activity between teachers and students ought not to occur, and if it occurs, it would be a violation of the Code of Ethics. I think that we have accomplished that in the amendments and additions to sub 10, and frankly, we included language such as you'll see illicit sexual communication to avoid any of the headache that people might think or occur regarding sex education, which is appropriate in varying settings. And so that does not prohibit that type of communication. It's that illicit, improper communication that we want to prohibit. But that's the rule regarding the obligations to the students. The next rule, 2408-0302, resolves the Code of Ethics obligations to the public. Now, this is, as I would suggest, at sub 8. The changes being suggested in sub 8 would simply mirror a rule that already exists for administrators. Let me comment on that briefly. There's a teachers commission that handles teachers. There's an administrative commission that handles school administrators, principals, the business manager, and the like. There's a current code of ethics rule for administrators that says you have to exemplify high moral standards and not engage in these activities. Corollary, there should be one for students. So we recognize that that's a fix that should be made to the rule. And so sub 8 is a close mirror, I will suggest, of the administrative rule, but it does add in the sexual contact with students, and that would be in addition to the administrative rule that already exists. So I suggest that that's simply a fix to mirror these ethical obligations of both teachers and administrators. Lastly, 2408-04-0101. All that does, folks, is add executive secretary. That's the appropriate statutory term if you look at SDCL 13-43-20.01. it refers that the commission may appoint an executive secretary. And there's also an accompanying rule for the administrators. I suspect that in the next month or two, we'll have a rule in front of you that's going to make certain that these two rules for the procedure for filing the complaint closely mirror each other for both the teachers and the administrators. Starting with the teachers first, we want to fix this just to refer it to an executive secretary. Those are the three rules that I have for you folks today. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bashan. Are there any questions of Mr. Bashan by the committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt.
Please proceed, Representative Hunt.
Mr. Bashan, first question would be, what are the sanctions under Rule 24.08.03.02 obligations to the public?
Thank you for the question. The statutory the sanctions involve a public or private reprimand or referring the matter to the Secretary of the Department of Education for proceedings to suspend or revoke the certificate. Those are the statutory sanctions that would be authorized for a violation of the Code of Ethics. So if the teacher has been, if a complaint has been filed with the teacher for violating this, the commission would have that variety of options. And if it would be for the revocation of the certificate, they would vote to refer it on to the secretary for proceedings to revoke the certificate or suspend the certificate. That ultimate decision is with the Secretary of the Department of Education.
Thank you for those comments. Just a follow-up in part to that. Item number 7, paragraph 7 under that rule, says engage in no act that results in a conviction. How does the community treat a Class 2 misdemeanor-type conviction? Is there a public or a private reprimand? What happens, to the best of your knowledge, in most of the cases where you have just a minor offense such as that?
Thank you. Since I've been working with the commission the last few years, we've not had one that came to us that involved a Class 2 misdemeanor conviction. You know, that could be a speeding ticket, which is technically a Class 2, Representative Hunt, as you're aware, a disorderly conduct, things like that. We've not necessarily had any of those in front of us. I don't know how I would guess to answer that, but I would suggest to you that they do look at these on a scale of, at the low end, the private reprimand, then the public, and then the referring it on to revoke the certificate. I don't know if that helps you, Representative, or not.
Well, I appreciate the comment. As I was just looking at conviction, you know, I can see where, you know, a traffic ticket, a Class 2 misdemeanor of some sort, wouldn't necessarily, in my opinion, necessarily require generation of some sort of a public reprimand. On the other hand, if someone gets two or three Class 2 misdemeanors over a five-year period, that may be indicative. And so I was wondering basically what the teachers are doing in that regard. And I appreciate your comments. I'm satisfied with your comments. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. Further questions of the committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Valley.
Senator Valley, please ask. Please proceed.
Are the sanctions the same for obligations to the students in 24.08.03.01?
That's exactly correct, yes. A violation of the Code of Ethics would carry a sanction from a private reprimand to a referring the matter on for revocation, correct.
Thank you.
Further questions of members of the committee? Hearing on, Mr. Bashan, I have a couple questions for you. I have to admit my ignorance of this commission, the existence of this commission. Can you tell me how active this commission has been in the last few years and how it interacts with school district discipline?
Thank you. Good question. I'm trying to remember, Representative, the number of complaints. I would suggest we're fairly active. We've had, in last month or so, three contested case hearings in front of us. Prior to that, in December and last year, we had a number of contested case hearings. So, you know, I would suggest it's a generally active committee. And they act when someone files a complaint, and that could be either a school district or it could be the Attorney General's office, for example, and they know that a teacher's been convicted of an offense, and so they'll file that complaint with us. So I would, they're a fairly active committee, I would suggest to you, and they follow those due process requirements under 126 and hold those contested case hearings. Did I miss another question in there, Representative?
If you just could follow up on that, how does this commission then piggyback or interact with a school district disciplining a teacher?
Good question. What we ask for when the initial complaint is filed is a rendition of what occurred at the local level. In other words, what activity did the district take to discipline the teacher? And that then goes into determination as to, frankly, initially, once they receive the complaint, if it has the notation that the district did X, Y, and Z regarding this matter with the teacher, the commission may vote not to go forward because it's been handled by the district. Or it may be a seriousness of a nature that's been reported, even if the district would terminate the teacher, that they may feel it needs to go further for a hearing. So I would suggest we do examine what the district has provided us for that information in order to make some determination to go forward or not. Does that help?
That does. That clarifies it very well. Thank you. The last question I would have would be, is this rule change in response? I know we dealt with some legislation in judiciary, House Judiciary last year, on similar matters. Is this in response to that legislation?
No, it's not at all. It, frankly, it's just in response to the commission seeing these activities brought in front of the commission to render a decision and, frankly, looking at the rules. And as I said before, I mean, it fits in those other two subcategories, but it's clear to just make a ethical rule so teachers know that this activity is prohibited.
Very good. Thank you. Did any other members of the committee have any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bashan, who chooses the members for these committees, and what are the particular standards for membership on this commission?
Thank you. The members are appointed by the governor. The terms generally run 3 years, as I recall, and the qualifications, I think, were consistent with what I indicated earlier. Six of them have to be a teacher engaged in the profession, and then a parent of a student in an educational setting. Six have to be employed as full-time teachers. Four have to be classroom teachers. None can be administrators. One from the general public, neither a teacher nor a school board, but a member of a parent of a pupil attending a 12-year program of education. SDCL 134317.
Thank you for that clarification.
Further questions, Representative Gibson?
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
Any other members of the committee have questions for Mr. Bashan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt.
Yes.
Mr. Bashan, what is going to be the plan? This is a follow-up, I believe, to the chairman's earlier question. What's going to be the plan to notify the teachers across the state about these changes? Now, obviously, we shouldn't have to notify teachers about the fact that illegal drugs and sexual conduct and whatnot are no-nos, but as I look at the last two items from subparagraph 8 to talk about the use of misleading or false statements, that in essence is kind of possibly a new subject. Is there going to be a program? Is the commission recommending, for example, to the Department of Education to promulgate some specific statements relative to these rules? Is there anything in the works in that regard?
Thank you, Representative Hunt. As I recall, and I'm looking out at the audience at Fern, we did place these on the Department of Ed website, I believe, at some time when we're going through this process. So they exist out there on the website. I will inform the committee that I have had conversations via email with Attorney Ann Plooster. She's an attorney in Pierre that does work with, I think it's SDEA, the Education Association, in other words, the teacher's attorney, as I would suggest. And so I provided her with these rules. I suspect that it'll be sent to the members, but we'll do our best to make certain that that's provided so folks know that these are new changes. We haven't necessarily developed what a plan of sending them out, but we've tried to make them as public as possible by putting it on the website.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. With that, Mr. Bashan, could you tell me if there are any other proponents or opponents that are going to testify on behalf of these rules there in peer?
I don't believe so.
Okay, thank you. Any proponents or opponents in any other location? Hearing none, with that, we will close this part of the meeting to public testimony and open it up for action of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move due pass of these rules.
Second. Thank you, Representative Gibson. We have a motion to due pass these rule changes by Representative Gibson and a second by Senator Hunstead. With that, all those in favor of these changes, vote aye. Those nay. And the Secretary, please call the roll.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunstead. Senator Hunstead. Hunhoff.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Senator Hunstead. Representative Lust.
Aye.
Did you get me? It just came back on. We were out of connection. I vote aye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Motion passes. With that, we'll pass the gavel on to Mitchell, Senator Valley.
Thank you, Representative Lust. Today we have two sets of rules by the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks, and I would like to take those separately. As you are discussing these, it has to do with big game licenses, the free licenses we passed this past year, and plumage that's needed for birds. As you go through these, if you would maybe help us out and explain why the large increases and the large decreases in some of the big game permits would be helpful. Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Senator Valley, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Emmett Kieser. I'm the Assistant Director of the Division of Wildlife, standing in for Director Life. In his absence, I'll try and move fairly quickly through the rules, but certainly want to try and address all the questions that may come as a result of our discussion today. Yesterday, I believe I did send some additional information out in a more tabular form that was requested by Senator Hunhoff, information on the Black Hills deer, West River deer, and East River deer seasons. Sent that via email. I'm not sure if everyone received that or not, but rules, I've got seven sets of rules here that we'll go through that the Commission finalized at their June meeting, and I'll move, again, fairly quickly through those. Again, if there are questions on specific units, I'll certainly try and highlight where we have some significant changes. In terms of the fall turkey season for the Black Hills and West River Prairie units, one significant change there was deleting a special unit in Stanley County. Most of you are aware that we essentially have developed a large West River unit for fall turkey and throughout western South Dakota, essentially reducing complexity of the regulations probably providing additional flexibility for our managers with those licenses. And moving on to the East River units for fall turkey on page 3 of your packet of 24 pages, 4106, 1402, 01. We did add two new units in the eastern part of the state, a new unit in Dual County, and another new unit in Moody County provides some additional opportunity where turkey populations have grown. In addition, there were a number of units where we did manipulate tags. We have some units where we increased tags from single tag turkey licenses to two tag licenses to address some growing turkey populations and hopefully prevent any winter depredation situations from occurring in those hunting units. Our net increase of 625 tags in East River is fairly significant in terms of the overall number of tags that are issued. Moving on then to the Black Hills deer season. The population of deer in the Black Hills continues to decline, and hunter success has suffered as a result of that declining population. Hunter success averaged on in 2006 about 60%. That's declined now to about 48% this past year, 2009. Staff are going to be evaluating Black Hills deer management, and over the next year we're going to solicit public comments and input on that season. I think most of you are well aware that we do have a large predator, mountain lions, that we're dealing with in terms of impacts on our Black Hills deer populations. You know, our research would indicate it is fairly significant in terms of the number of deer that are taken by mountain lions. Again, I would refer you to the specific information that I sent in tabular form for Black Hills deer. Overall there, you can see that there was a small decrease in the number of any deer tags from 500 to 400 any deer licenses, and then we decreased the whitetail licenses from 4,500 to 4,000. Most significantly, we reduced the number of antlerless licenses that are available in the special deer units in the Black Hills. The total reduction went from 1,800 in 2009 down to 400 in 2010, a decrease of about 78%. Again, pretty significant decrease based, again, on the concern with the Black Hills deer population. We have noted and had concerns from folks who say, well, it sure seems like there's still a lot of deer in the Black Hills. When they're driving around, they'll see the deer in the meadows. When you take and apply the number of deer that are seen in those meadow areas to the entire Black Hills, the decline is pretty substantial, and hunters, I think, are noting that during the hunting season. Moving on then to the West River Prairie deer season, again, an overall decrease in tags, about 11%. Again, our hunter success continues to decline in parts of that area, primarily in the northern units in western South Dakota. Again, would refer you to the table information that I sent via email, if you have it in front of you, but there are a few units that we did increase in proposed increase in number of tags in due to rising deer populations. Units in Bennett County, Jackson County, Jones County, and Lyman County in particular. But we did decrease licenses and tag numbers in Custer Pennington Unit, Unit 21 A and B. Decreased the tag numbers in Harding County and Perkins County in particular due to a number of years of 2 years at least running of bad winters, and a resultant decrease in the productivity of the deer population in those areas. Moving on then to page 20 of your packet, I do want to draw attention to a statute that was passed during this past legislative session dealing with the issuance of up to two free antlerless deer licenses to landowners. The legislation did set out a number of criteria and did afford the commission the opportunity to identify certain criteria in allowing the issuance of those free licenses. But the commission essentially is going to issue those two free licenses to anyone who requests those, any qualifying landowners, where there's at least one antlerless Western deer tag available following the second lottery drawing. So essentially there is some restriction to the areas where licenses would remain following the second drawing. And that was done in an effort to provide for fairness in distribution or allocation of licenses and the opportunity. Moving on then, again, page 21 of 24, we'll deal with trapping prohibitions. The commission did deal with a regulation that would extend the season in which trappers could trap muskrats. We've received a number of comments from trappers about the request for this extension due to the good ice conditions, high muskrat population, and relatively good market prices for furs. A number of trappers have come to us and asked if we could extend that date from March 1st through March 16th, wherein trappers could actually get out and trap on or in muskrat houses. The basis of that rule essentially is that if we extend that date too long, there may be some unintended catches of waterfowl that are migrating back into the state. So we're sort of on the cusp there with that date of March 16th, but we did feel it was important to provide that additional opportunity to the trappers given the high populations of muskrats and the good fur prices. Moving down that same page, page 22, 4108.02.14 essentially is a regulation that mirrors another regulation where we're essentially trying to provide equal opportunity to all people. We received a number of complaints from trappers down in particular in the southeast corner of the state wherein trappers are placing stakes or cables or traps, snares and other devices, and essentially placing them prior to the start of a season to essentially claim trapping areas on those public road rights of way. And this would essentially provide more of a level playing field and prohibit anyone from placing those traps or snares prior to the start of the season. Again, this is a pretty similar regulation. We don't allow people to, ahead of the muskrat season, go out and flag or place any traps on or in a muskrat house prior to the start of the season. Moving down then at the bottom of that page, 4109.0104 would essentially allow shooting preserves the opportunity to remove the plumage of birds that are harvested on shooting preserves. You may recall that we had a similar regulation put into place this last year wherein we allowed wildlife processing facilities to remove all the plumage from pheasants, for example, to enable the shipping of those birds without plumage. The reason that the shooting preserves made this request is they have a number of folks who leave birds on the preserve. Some leave them there because of the lack of appearance of table fare. If the head or wing or foot is left on them, the preserves are feeling like they may be able to enhance the utilization and the number of birds that are taken home by those who visit shooting preserves by presenting them in a package container minus the other appendages. So the commission did provide that opportunity through this rule and essentially places them, the preserves, on par with the wildlife processing facilities in the rule that was passed this past year. Finally, down towards the bottom of page 23, 4109.0204, we had an individual appear before our commission who requested that quail also be exempted from the requirement to clip a front toe or hind toe on either foot. The individual raises quail as a personal hobby project. In the following discussion with staff, it was determined that there really isn't any biological or regulatory need to any longer require the marking of quail that are released by an individual to the wild. The individual's comment was that when he marks the quail, their toes are so small when he clips them off, he has a difficult time seeing them because of his age. So with that, Senator Valley, I think we're through the rules. If there are some specific questions on this packet, I would most certainly entertain them.
Does anyone have any questions of Mr. Keyser on
Senator
these
Valley.
Rules.
Senator Valley, Senator Hunstead here.
Go ahead, Senator Hunstead.
Yes, I would just have one comment and one question. The comment on the muskrats is I appreciate that. They do a tremendous amount of damage to our roads in Brown County where we've got high water along the roads, and so the additional trapping opportunities should be a benefit to the counties and the roads as well as the sportsmen. The question would deal with the decrease in licenses in Brown County. We still have quite a large problem with deer, and while perhaps the numbers are down a little bit with the amount of water we've got, we have concentrated these deer, and I guess I wanted you to comment on what the counts were or how we decided to reduce that number of licenses by 10%.
Senator Valley, with your permission, the deer population in Brown County, due to the high water, of course, has pushed a lot of those animals out of some of their traditional slough areas where they reside throughout the year. We did decrease the target harvest population from 6,000 tags to 5,500 tags now from 2009 to 2010, which essentially is about an 8% drop. There still are a fair number of deer, but we feel like we're trying to track harvest and respond to some of the success issues that hunters have shared with us. Our staff continues to gather public comment through meetings and those kinds of formats, and of course works with local sportsmen's clubs on those season proposals. So we feel that decrease of 8% probably is in line with what we've seen in terms of the deer population, and again, with the higher water areas throughout Brown County and much of eastern South Dakota, we're seeing where deer are really not in the numbers that we've had traditionally over the last 10 years.
Well, I would, excuse me, if I may follow.
Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, that is my point. I would not argue with you that the number of deer, the population may well be down, but with the concentration that has occurred because of the flooding, we seem to have more of them concentrated, and we still have a serious problem. I guess I would continue to want you to look and try to balance it out so that we don't have more problems with the farmers and ranchers than we've had in the past, because it looks like it could be tough.
Point certainly well taken. And we'll certainly track those numbers here over the next year or so and ask our staff to look a little closer at the Brown County area in particular.
Further questions?
Senator Valley?
Go ahead, Representative Hunhoff. Or
Thank
Senator
you.
Hunhoff.
Thank you. Well, I requested the data, and sort of as a follow-up to Senator Hunstead, I guess this is my question. What is the data suggesting as far as what you're picking up, what your people that pick up dead deer along the roadways, what's that kind of information providing you? Because we do you see a decline in that since we don't have this many deer, or what's happening in that arena?
Senator Valley, with your permission, we are seeing a continuation of a number of deer, especially along the interstate areas. Dead deer are picked up there under contract, cooperative contract between DOT and the department. In addition, DOT has indicated to us that they will be restarting contracts on a number of state highway stretches as well. But overall, there are some units where we have actually seen a decline in the number of deer and those that are hit and found on the road right of ways, in particular in the East River, units of Coddington, Brookings decreased pretty significantly, McCook County as well, and then Turner County. Many of the other units remained relatively stable. We did see some increased harvest, however, in Brule County, and we're proposing increased harvest in Hyde County, as well. Pretty substantial increase there, as there is in proposed to be in McPherson County. So it's kind of a mixed bag, I guess, of numbers, but you know, we're certainly continuing to work with DOT and trying to remove those deer in a timely fashion from both the interstate and the state highway system and other high traffic or high deer vehicle strike areas as well.
Can I have a second or a follow-up?
Go ahead, cool. Senator.
Thank you. Well, I guess that's my point. I routinely travel on a regular basis 2 to 3 times a week within, you know, a 35-mile radius of Yankton, and I have not seen a decrease in the number of dead deer that I see along that way. And the one other question I have, you alluded to that you have meetings. Where does one find out where you have these meetings and you're talking to clubs and you're talking to landowners? And I guess because I'm from the south east corner, I'm real interested in that because I've only attended one meeting and deer populations were not something that was mentioned. So how is the consumer or the citizen knowing about these meetings that you're having specifically related to collecting data of deer out there?
Senator Belli, Representative Hunhoff, the meetings that are held are normally advertised by the conservation officers. They'll set those up themselves through the and notify citizens through local media. Oftentimes, if there are not particular issues with, for example, the deer season, there may be other issues, for example, with Canada geese or the kinds of wildlife, whether landowners or others are experiencing damage or have concerns about the season structure. So we'll focus, you know, on those kinds of issues. What I will do is certainly make a point to advise our region staff out of Sioux Falls to make special notification to you and to be sure that there's sufficient notice provided to the public when they host those meetings.
Thank you. I'm not asking for special notice. I'm just trying to identify because I am really concerned of the number that we're seeing, and I can appreciate if you're talking about the mountain lions and the Black Hills deer, but I'm seeing a decline, and I'm not as frequent driver to Pierce since we've cut out meetings going there, but certainly there are a lot of dead deer along the roadway, so it tells me if there's dead deer, then we still have an area. And I know this morning I was talking to some of the constituents talking about this, and you know, the same question is arising. Wow, I didn't realize that we're seeing that kind of decline in the numbers. So, you know, again, you're the experts, the commission is making the decision, but certainly this is a recreational aspect of South Dakota that's very important, and as we're seeing a decline in numbers, when just, you know, not too long ago, we were hearing the arguments in Pierre about deprivation and what are we paying our ranchers and that whole scenario. So it just seems in a very short period of time that we're now going in the opposite direction. Thank you.
Welcome.
Further questions by the committee? If not, Mr. Keiser, I may stimulate some, but I do have some questions. In the northwestern part of the state where we really saw some decrease, you know, in Harding and Perkins County, I mean, we dropped licenses there, 1,900, 1,400, 2,800. That's a lot of license changes. Is this due to weather? Is it due to disease? Is it why are we seeing this huge number of decrease in the population that you're feeling is there to decrease the number of licenses?
Primarily due to winter loss, both the winter loss itself and the actual death of the animals there, and in addition to that, there's a loss in productivity as a result of fetuses or eggs being reabsorbed by the big game animals. So that The areas probably north of Highway 212 in particular, and maybe even north of Highway 20, were probably hardest hit in the western portion of the state over the last 2 years. And so these pretty substantial drops are in response to what we're seeing out there in terms of the surveys, and also what we're seeing in terms of success and comments from the hunting public out there.
Okay. I noticed that in the wild turkey, there were some areas that you didn't have licenses, but you get points for no licenses. How do you determine that if there's no licenses offered, you still get points for applying? Can you explain that thought process?
Sure, be happy to. The ability to apply for a preference point is a fairly new concept, probably implemented here 4 or 5 years ago. The idea being that if someone had plans or had a conflict and wouldn't be able to participate in the hunt that year, there was still a mechanism for them to acquire a preference point for that particular season through application. And that zero number of licenses essentially just creates a unit where they can apply for a specific type of license, whether it's an East River deer, West River deer, turkey, etc. But it just allows them to continue to accrue a preference point, even though they may not be able to participate in a hunt that year and really didn't want to participate in a drawing due to the conflict that they had.
So it's not just if you applied and were denied one because all the sufficient you didn't make the drawing cut.
Correct. You would actually intentionally apply for that unit to gain that preference point, knowing that you wouldn't be able to participate in the hunt. And simply, it's just a mechanism that we created to allow hunters to accrue those preference points through the application process. That way, they could have a higher likelihood of drawing the following year when they would be available and didn't have a scheduling conflict with their hunt.
Okay. Could you go over the law that we passed this year on the licenses? And I asked Mr. Decker to pull that law, and I couldn't, because I was going to research that and forgot. I can't remember how we gave that discretionary authority. So the way you have it written now is that if there are licenses left after the second drawing, then I can, if I'm a farmer or rancher on my own land, I can apply for a free license. Other than that, I can't. And it doesn't say how many licenses then would become available. Is it the number that you still had allocated for that area? And because you say that one would have to be left, but does that mean there would only be one available, or how would you distribute those licenses then?
Senator Bell, that's a good question, and it is a little confusing. The number of licenses that are allocated through the SDCL 41619.8 really is just essentially determined by the legislation. It's two per qualifying household, and they would be available in unlimited numbers. In other words, the department really establishes no specific limit for those licenses. It's really driven by the legislation itself. Now, when the commission was granted the authority to designate which areas those would be able to be used in, principally, I think, to maintain their control of the management of the herd. You know, it's not likely there will be a huge number of folks who will have an interest in acquiring these licenses West River, but the commission, I think, and staff are well aware that there will be quite a little demand in the eastern part of the state due primarily to the numbers of landowners. And so in the rule itself, what it attempts to do is to identify units where we would have licenses left over and available anyway, and there would be plenty of deer there to harvest, obviously, because the target harvest that was proposed, those number of licenses haven't certainly been sold, and so there is and would be animals available to harvest in those units. So the intent is that the legislature says we're going to allow up to two But we'll let the commission determine where and in which units those will be made available in, and to a large extent, the idea being that we would target those areas that have higher deer populations and the potential for deer depredation problems.
Chairman Valley, this is Doug Decker. You'd ask me to look up the statute. The statute, as Mr. Keyser has cited, is 41-6-19.8. It provides the criteria as he has outlined it. And it, if you're looking at the session law, it was Chapter 209, Section 1, and it was from House Bill 1264.
Okay, if I may, Mr. Decker, it appears then that the rule fits, because I couldn't remember the discretion we gave to the department or to the Game Fish and Parks to allocate those licenses where they would be at.
Yes. Chairman Valley, this is Doug Decker again. The rule fits the criteria as outlined in the statute. There is discretion granted to the department to designate the areas on the lands that this license is available.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Another question I have is the when we're talking about the plumage issue, what is a definition of a wildlife processing facility? Is that defined in rule or law somewhere? And then are we allowing a preserve then to be a wildlife processing facility? Could you explain that a little bit? And it would only be those licensed preserves that could do this, and is there any regulation of those?
Another good question, Senator Valley. Wildlife processing facility is actually defined in rule under 41060310. A wildlife processing facility essentially is any person or entity that has a South Dakota sales tax license to operate a business that receives, possesses, or has in custody any wild animal as defined in 4111 belonging to another person for purposes of picking, skinning, cleaning, freezing, processing, or storage. Because shooting preserves meet those criteria, they are in effect, a wildlife processing facility, and so they are defined, and we have made the allocation or the allowance then through the specific shooting preserve rule to allow them to essentially remove the plumage from those birds at that processing facility.
Okay, thank you. Are there any further questions by the committee? There are no further, are there any other proponents or opponents to these rules? Any further proponents or opponents to these rules? There are none. We'll close it to public testimony and open it up to committee discussion and or action.
Senator Valley,
Senator Hunhoff has moved, and Representative Lust has seconded the motion to approve the rules as written. All those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, say nay. The secretary, please call the roll.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye. We have a majority that have approved the rules as written, and so they will be approved as written. We now move on to the second set of rules, and which will be the last set of rules for the day. Mr. Keyser.
Thank you, Senator. We'll move again through these relatively quickly, but certainly want to allow plenty of time for questions if there are questions. The first season we're going to deal with is the early fall Canada goose hunting season. We're essentially adjusting some unit boundaries there. That appears on page one of your packet for the June 2010 proposals, July 2010 finals. Probably the bigger issue that the commission dealt with within that particular rule was the proposal by the staff to repeal the rule that prohibits non-residents from hunting during the early Canada goose season in the counties of Beetle, Brookings, Hanson, Kingsbury, Lake, Lincoln, McCook Minor, Minnehaha, Moody, Sanborn, Turner, and Union. Staff had essentially brought a proposal before the commission as one more mechanism for us to aid in the reduction of the numbers of Canada geese. But following some overwhelming public testimony at the commission meeting, the commission chose not to repeal that prohibition. So essentially, non-residents would continue to be prohibited from hunting during the early Canada goose season in those particular counties. The issue of limits was also, of course, dealt with as a part of this season, and because our Canada goose population continues to grow, and I think you dealt with it previously, we've put in to process an earlier early August take season. Essentially, it's a permit allowance from the federal government that allows hunters to harvest Canada geese as early as August 1st. The early Canada goose season that takes place in September then is one additional opportunity ahead of the regular season to harvest additional geese. The limit issue is actually dealt with on page 24 of your packets, and I didn't want to forget that particular rule, but we are and did propose to increase the daily limit from 5 to 8 Canada geese per day and allow a person to possess up to 16 Canada geese as a part of the early fall Canada goose season. Moving on then to the East River deer season. Again, there's an overall change. We decreased the number of tags about 1%. Number of licenses is actually down about 4%. Since 2005, we have seen a pretty substantial decline in the success rates for hunters, although we have offered since that time substantially more tags. Hunter success has declined from about 58% in 2005 down to about 42%. In 2009. Again, the specific unit information, I think we did have some discussion on previously when we covered the other rules. But again, also want to point out that the same criteria was put in place for the free landowner antlerless licenses that are issued to farmers and ranchers as a result of House Bill 1264. You'll find that on page 11. Of your information packet there. Again, if there is at least one antlerless East River deer tag available in the second, or excuse me, if there's one tag available, antlerless tag, the licenses will be made available to qualifying landowners in those units. Moving on then to the antelope season, we've substantially decreased the number of antelope licenses and tags available. Our success rates, again, have gone down pretty substantially, 64% in 2005, down to 44% in 2009. Again, primarily due to the decrease in the antelope population in those northern tier counties in the western part of the state. We have, in addition to decreasing the number of licenses in many of those areas, we also eliminated the split seasons in Perkins and Zeebach counties. Normally, we use those split seasons as another mechanism to place more hunters in the field so that there aren't conflicts between hunters we don't send too many hunters out in the field with landowners when we have those high numbers of tags issued, because we backed off pretty substantially on the number of tags in the antelope season. We felt it was more appropriate to also eliminate that split season and maintain some consistency. With that, I'll move on to refuge deer. Dealing with Sand Lake and Wall Bay refuges in particular, we essentially proposed to adjust the season dates for the first season in Sand Lake. And We also amended the dates for the antlerless extension. We have a start date of the day following Christmas for the special antlerless extension season. And that runs nine consecutive days beginning on the 26th of December throughout East River, and then also for these special refuge deer seasons. In terms of the Wabay season, we also adjusted the start date to make it more generic so that we didn't have to come back again in future time and change the date on that rule. Essentially, that start date of the Wabay season, if you look on page 23, would be 8 days prior to the beginning of the East River deer season. And finally, I don't think I need to cover it again, but we did propose to change the limit during the early Canada goose season from 5 to 8 per day. And with that, Senator Valley, I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Are there questions by the committee?
Representative, or Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Representative Loss.
Mr. Teaser, if you could just, out here it's a little bit more controversial than probably East River, but the purchase of the Hill property near Angostura, could you explain why that or how that happened and the tax ramifications, the real property tax ramifications?
I'll certainly do my best to answer the questions. We did have an opportunity, and of course, generally when we have, in almost every instance, we have landowners who come to us and ask if the department may have an interest in buying a piece of property. They come forward as willing sellers. The department then generally does an appraisal of the property. We, in fact, did two appraisals of this property, and the commission has had this property under consideration for a number of months. The opportunity that was presented to our agency was that we had a federal aid bubble, if you will, of funds that came to us. There's a certain time frame wherein we're allowed to expend those funds, a two-year time frame, and there is and has been quite a little interest from local sports sportsmen and individuals for the opportunity to have an area that could be managed for upland game bird hunting. The Hill property is down adjacent on the west side of Angostura Reservoir. The property itself has some lower land that is adjacent to the reservoir that provides some outstanding opportunity to manage habitats for upland game birds like pheasants. In addition, there's some acres of property that are up kind of in the rolling hills and the prairie pine forest area there that would provide access to some additional Forest Service properties there. As I said, the commission has had discussion on the Hill property for a number of months now and has had it under consideration, and the opportunity presented itself with the funding mix and the opportunity to purchase the property, and so the department brought that forward to the commission for consideration, and they did proceed to move for purchase. Other questions? Did I adequately answer that?
Just what are the real property tax?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's an important point. I'm glad you ask again. The property taxes are paid by the department on those properties that are acquired as game production areas. The Hill property would be managed as a game production area. We'll continue to pay ag taxes as they've been paid in the previous years. The department pays those taxes throughout the state and on the properties that we purchase as game production areas, and so they'll continue to be paid to the county.
And what source are those funds, the property taxes, from?
Those come from, again, the game fund, which is hunting and fishing license fees.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions by the committee? I do have one question. I think I missed it. I heard you discussing, and I'm reading it again. the non-resident early goose season. Could you cover that again? Or it appears that you repealed the ban on non-resident early season, this depredation season. Could you explain that again, Mr. Keiser?
You bet, Senator Belli. There was a proposal that was brought by staff as part of the early fall Canada goose season to repeal the prohibition on non-residents hunting down in those southeast counties. The commission, as I said, following testimony from a substantial number of citizens in the southeast corner of the state, decided not to repeal the ban on non-residents. So the ban on non-resident hunting during the early fall Canada goose season remains in place and continues in rule. There was no, of course, change in rule as a result of not moving forward with that repeal, so it really doesn't appear in your packet. But the commission did, during the testimony at the rule finalization in July, did opt not to repeal that that prohibition. So that stays in place.
Okay, I think I garnered that from the summary that we had, and it says repeal the rule which prohibits non-residents from hunting in the counties of Beetle, Brookings, Hanson, Kingsbury, Lincoln, McCook, Minor, Minnehaha, Moody, Sanborn, and so on. But you did not repeal that.
Correct. The commission opted not to repeal that that prohibition.
Okay. Further questions by the committee? If there are there any other proponents for these rules? Any further proponents? Last call for proponents. Are there any opponents to these rules? Any opponents? Last call for opponents. If there are no further proponents or opponents, we'll close the testimony to the public and open it up for discussion and or action.
Move to pass, Mr. Chairman.
Second, Mr. Chairman. Gibson.
It's been moved by Senator Hunstad and seconded by Representative Gibson to approve the rules as written. Those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, say nay. The Secretary will call the roll.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunstad.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye. The rules have a majority of the members, and so the rules are approved as written. And at this point, I will turn the gavel over to the chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Thanks to all of you. Things moved along very well today. Appreciate your labors. Just a reminder that we will commence on August 31st at 10 o'clock. Probably have the same setup as far as using, we will have the same setup as far as using DDM is concerned. Chris, just for your information, I'll send you my guest register, but the two people here were Joyce, J-O-Y-C-E-B-O-S, and Laura Wodey, spelled Laura, L-A-U-R-A, Wodey, W-O-I-T-T-E. I will send you the list. Any other comments by any members of the committee? Mr. Decker, do you have any closing comments?
No, sir.
Chris, anything we need to be reminded of?
No.
All right. Hearing nothing further, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I so move, Mr. Chairman. Gibson.
Moved by Representative Gibson to adjourn. Seconded by?
Senator Valley will second.
Good old Senator Valley. Thank you for the second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion to adjourn will say aye. Chris, call the roll, please.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunstad.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye. Members of the committee, that concludes today's hearing. Thank you all very much. Have a good week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.